You're listening to the Youth Crick Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at WUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at WUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
Field.
Years behind bars for his part in a gangland murder.
Yes. Chopping up his
with no
wife.
Gang members.
Stealing, extorting, and
50 attacks in the first 5 months.
Nine killing
streets of violence to rival
the world we live in is not what it seems. There are evil forces lurking beneath the surface. Criminals.
You gotta love drugs.
Pipe it up.
Look at me. I'm a hooker or something.
Maniacs. And the insane. A plan so sinister is developing, not even the law can neutralize it.
Irid's Yerky!
But there is one man.
Yo, what the fuck is that?
Who will stand up and bring justice down on those who deserve it.
Motherfucker!
You're dying, and I don't give a fuck. In fact, I'm happy about it.
But when you live on the edge...
All right.
Anything can happen.
Look at me, I'm a big fucking idiot.
My name is...
Podcast, I am here with Greg DeLiso, is that correct?
Very, very close, man. Thank you. It's Greg DeLiso, but most people say DeLiso. They add an extra I, and you did not. So I give you a lot of props and kudos for that. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Yes, Greg DeLiso. Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
And today, listeners, we are going to be interviewing Greg on his new movie, Hectic Knife, from Trauma Films. And so, Greg, I'm going to just start by asking you, how did you get your start in the film business and what's your background in filmmaking?
Well, I got bitten by the movie bug, as they say, when I was just 6 years old. I saw Jurassic Park in the theater, and I saw it like 3 or 4 more times after that as a kid. I was just, I'm a Spielberg kid, like at heart. He was my first big influence. And so when I was 6 years old, I was already like thinking about movies all the time, and I started to take it more seriously when I was probably in my early teens. I started reading about a lot like 70s independent movies, like, and filmmakers like Kubrick and Scorsese and Woody Allen, and I got really interested in that stuff. And then I got really serious about it when I was in my mid-teens. I got my first camera. I started editing at home, and this was around 2000 or so. So I got very lucky because obviously the digital age was coming up. And so I was able to shoot and edit video right in my parents' basement there for pretty cheap. So I started on Adobe Premiere way back when it was the original Premiere editing system way back in 2000. And I learned on that, and I switched over to Final Cut Pro actually in high school when I was 17 in 2003. And I've been cutting ever since. And I think I moved to New York City right after high school. And I was 17 years old. I graduated. And then in that fall, right before I turned 18, I moved out to New York and I went to the New York Film Academy. And that's a year long directing program. Back when I went there, the tuition was about $24,000. Now it's probably like close to $40,000 because, I mean, the way it just keeps going up and everything's crazy. But it was good. I got a lot out of it. It was, they had, a lot of gear. They was really hands-on. We were shooting and cutting all the time and really meeting people. And I made some great friends that I'm still friends with today. I started interning when I was still in school, and I got my first paying gig out in New York when I was 18. And I started freelancing. And I'm proud to say that I just turned 31 a couple months ago, and I've never had a real job. I've never done any job outside of the movie business. The only ways I've ever gotten paid in my life were for either PAing on a commercial or directing something or a music video or cutting or whatever. So I'm proud of that. Never had the 9-to-5, never went to college, never had a backup plan. Just been kind of, I lived as a starving artist from about 17 to 25 or so, when I finally started making some decent money at the craft. And I'm back here in Detroit now where I live. I've grew up in Detroit, you know, the suburbs of Detroit. And I'm back here now. I've been here for a few years and I got married and I have a house. And you can see behind me, well, you won't see on the podcast, but behind me is my big studio and all that stuff. So I'm just out here making movies. And yeah, I think that that kind of covers it. I've been kind of doing it since I was a little kid, serious about it since teen years, and making money since my late teens. And now I'm about 30. So
going back to filmmakers, what very quickly, what were your who are your filmmakers that have influenced you the most?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so to start off, I mean, it was Spielberg, in the sense that Spielberg was the first person that I understood by name as like a guy that made a movie. And I was too young to even understand what that actually meant. I mean, I remember seeing Jurassic Park in the theater and simultaneously thinking, well, I really want to study dinosaurs and I also want to make movies, whatever this movie thing is. And so I got really into dinosaurs, but I remember the, if you remember that summer or whatever it was, that fall.
93?
Yeah, 93. So remember right after that, you know, Jurassic Park was obviously the biggest thing ever. And they made a really amazing hour-long making of, hosted by James Earl Jones, that was on TV. And I was like 6 years old and I was seeing Spielberg like directing this thing and I like this movie and I was on set. I didn't know what he was like doing. It didn't really make sense. But and I remember asking my grandpa, like, so did they have to film everything in order? And like, just it came out that way. And he kind of explained, and I, you know, but I was only like 6, 7, 8 years old. And so that was my real starting point. And then I'll say after that, Seinfeld and The Simpsons informed my comedy sort of brain and were like my other parents apart from my real parents, because I'm an only child. My entire youth was spent obsessively watching and basically studying every single episode of Simpsons up until about, I mean, it's funny now, there's more episodes of Simpsons that I haven't seen than that I have. It's been, I mean, I'm talking about The Simpsons from between when it started in 89 all the way up to like 2002 maybe is when I watched it. And, but I was obsessive about that. And then, but as far as directors specifically, the first big director that I got into aside from Spielberg was Kubrick. I was obsessive about him in, when I was around 12, 13, 14. And I, from him, I moved over to Scorsese. But right now, you know, my favorite directors of all time, I would say, are the Coen brothers. Robert Zemeckis is probably number one. Still Spielberg is high up there, but, people like Rob Reiner, Amy Heckerling, Penny Marshall, guys like that. And then a lot of the sort of indie, 90s people, I mean, even, Kevin Smith, Tarantino, Spike Lee, those were all big influences. Those were influences both. And then I love their movies, but I was also kind of, I came of age, I was 10 years old when indie sort of broke again, in the sense that the Oscars was, like Good Will Hunting was like winning a big Oscar and all these little people.
When Miramax were coming up.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, what's actually really funny now is that with Harvey Weinstein and all this awful, terrible stuff, yeah. My joke, and it's terrible, but my joke is that, you know, as a kid, I could never explain to anybody now how much at 10 years old it was my dream to have my career like ruined by Harvey Weinstein. Like that's the dream. It's like you grow up and you move to New York and then he like, you make this movie and then he like puts it on the shelf, like Shyamalan, like he did with Shyamalan. And then he's like, you know, stuck. And then he has to like, you have to break free and it's this whole thing. And then you eventually like work for him again and make this big Oscar movie. Like that's the dream. And then all of a sudden, you know, you find out he's like a horrible person and it's all a race. But no, I mean, Miramax informed a lot of my growing up. It was the film production company that made it seem like I could do something like that. And that's really special for anyone trying to make movies.
Right. And, you know, in Miramax, and not to go on a tangent, but Miramax, yes, was, they were pioneers for,
oh, yeah,
you know, what they were. I mean, they released Clerks. They released, I mean, you mentioned Good Will Hunting. They did release Shakespeare in Love, which has been controversial. But then they do The English Patient. So, I mean, they, and, you know, of course, all of Quentin Tarantino movies. So they were pioneers of the 90s.
Oh, absolutely.
Indie, yeah, cinema. So, mm-hmm, yeah. And Robert Rodriguez as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But moving to Hectic Knife, where did this idea come from?
Yeah. So, in Sorry, so I have to cut out all these stupid ums and ahs here. Let me just think for a sec. So I was back in the around 2010. I was living with Peter Litvin. He's one of my best friends from high school. You know, when I say we're from Detroit, we're from the northern suburbs. We're not from 8 Mile. We're from 22 Mile. So it's a lot different where we're from. But so yeah, we you know, kind of went to high school together, and he was a musician. He always had his bands and was making music and doing stuff. And I was a huge fan of his bands. I thought he was a great musician. So we were always kind of friends at a distance, whatnot. And then I had moved to New York right after high school, and he was kind of impressed by that. So he moved out there a couple of years later, and he happened to kind of be in touch with me because I was like the one that did that. So we talked, and he ended up moving to a neighborhood close to mine. And he became friends with some of my other friends out that were already out there. And it was kind of this, we were all kind of doing projects and stuff. And I ended up living on his couch to save money so I could survive. I was like kind of going deeper in the rabbit hole of the starving artist. By the time I was, you know, I had actually gotten a decent job as an editor at this now defunct TV channel in New York, called Imagination TV. I mean, this, it doesn't even exist anymore, but it was just, I had a, you know, job there back when I was like 20, but by the time I was 23, I was still gigging around and not making a ton, you know, not making any more than a grand a month and trying to survive. And especially in New York City, that's almost impossible. So Pete offered me his couch, and he set me up with a little retainer where it was basically, I would make like any stupid art project that he wanted me to make, and I couldn't like refuse it basically. And so we started making these short films, and Hector Knife was just one of them. And yeah, it's kind of, as soon as we started our little deal, Pete like went crazy and bought all these props and wigs and stuff. And so Hector Knife just sort of was he just naturally put the wig on and got the knives and wanted to kind of play around. And he started doing all these weird like movements as if he was training and doing like fake fighting. And I was filming that, and we just thought it was funny. I put it in the black and white. I kind of gave it this like weird 70s industrial like look to it. And the name popped into my head. It all kind of just were these little kind of light bulb accident things. And next thing I know, this is like 2010. Next thing I know, in a few months, we're making a movie already. Like, it was sort of, at first I was like, this is really funny, let's do a web series. And then we went to go shoot episode 2, and it was like 10 minutes long. And I was like, scrap that, let's just make a movie. And if you go on YouTube, you can actually see there's all the short films that we did like leading up to that time. And then also the original first like quote unquote episode that Hectic Knife was. If you go on the official Hectic Knife YouTube channel, it's called something like the first episode. I don't know what it is, but you can see it's like Hectic has a little scuffle in the hallway, and there's even some cool stop motion I did with a robot in there, a little toy robot. So nice. Just doing this fun stuff, and I think for me, the idea of what Hectic Knife really is, which to me is this sort of like modern superhero satire thing of, you know, kind of making fun of all movies at once, but nothing really that specific of a parody, but just sort of like making fun of all movie tropes at the same time, whether it be Hollywood or indie, and then also kind of poking fun at the sort of overblown length of the superhero movies and how they're all like 3 hours long and insane. So it was kind of like that. I sort of understood that was the direction it was going a month or two in, and then, you know, it took 6 years to make the movie, but that once I understood that, it kind of, it all started shaping and working together, and it became what it is now, a movie, you know, the movie that it is.
Awesome. So you went into a little bit of the production process of the movie, but can you explain like how many days did it actually take to shoot the movie, and what were some of the resources that you had, or what some of the challenges you had to overcome in making the movie?
Sure. So it was definitely not a traditional production in the sense that Peter and I never sat down and wrote a script from page 1 to 90 and then went out and cast it and, you know, locked off 35 days and shot it and then, you know, locked off time to edit. That we didn't do any of that. What we did instead was Pete was financing the first sort of you know, the first, I'd say that the, you know, the like 80% of the first production, which is when, you know, all the props and the casting and starting the shooting, he financed all that. And so that's how we're doing it. And because he financed it, we really worked 1 day a week sort of at a time, which means if you know anything about Peter Jackson and his first movie, Bad Taste, he kind of shot it almost the exact same way that we did Hectic Knife. And I'll actually I know it's a little bit of a tangent, but I hadn't seen Bad Taste, and we were halfway through the Hectic Night production, and I was, you know, 27 years old, I was, or five or something like that, and I was lonely. This was before I met my wife. I was kind of just like depressed and lonely, and I was watching Bad Taste for the first time, and I was thought it was cool, and I watched the commentary, and they were saying how they did the production. I was like, oh my God, this is exactly how we did Hectic Knives, because what happened was, because it was all financed out of Pete's pocket, it would be on Wednesday, we would walk around our neighborhood and write, and we would say, like, you know, Hectic Knife, he should have like a silly, weird roommate, like, shouldn't he? Like, well, what's the name? And we're just kind of bouncing these ideas off each other, and he would record it into his phone, and then he would go home that night and you know, to our place, and he would type it up. And that would become the shooting script for the next Monday, because Thursday, Friday, he would produce the shoot. And then Monday, we would shoot the scene with the actors. And we did that for about maybe 15 weeks consecutively. So we shot the first 15 days of production were like that. And then it got disjointed, because from that, I was able to make a rough cut. And that took me only like about 2 weeks. But that rough cut was put together in, say, I don't know, 2013. Well, it didn't come out all the way until 16, because we did ADR for 80% of the movie. So we re-recorded all the dialogue and all that stuff. And that took forever. That took 2 or 3 years on itself. But we also, you know, I like to say, when I first showed Pete the rough cut, I think it was an hour and 50 some minutes long. And from the time of showing him that first rough cut that I put together quickly till the end, you know, the end product is 82 minutes. So we essentially deleted out, like almost, you know, cut that thing in half almost, and then added back 10 new minutes that we shot after. So it was pretty remarkable, from going from an hour and a half, you know, or an hour, 50 minutes, and you cut out like 50 minutes all the way out of it or something like that, 40 minutes all the way out, and then 10 back in. And then that's where you got the movie. So it was a very long production. It was really like learning how to sort of make a movie and make it sort of dense enough and fast enough and paced the right way and enough jokes and everything to kind of sustain. And really that all took that amount of time to kind of learn like what it should be. And you know, all those things go into the process. But yeah, there were challenges all the way. I mean, at one point, you know, if you've seen the movie, there's a part where a little kid's head explodes. And that was a practical effect that we did that cost us $1,500, which at the time, that's like 10% of our budget, right? Yeah. Well, I basically learned in editing that we could have just done it essentially for like almost free and not had to have done all the work that we did. And it would have been exactly the same. So it's just lessons like that that you learn. I mean, it's like, you would say it's money wasted. Well, I mean, you know, it is, but it's a lesson learned, and it's thankfully not, you know, killing us on the money. It's only $1,500. And I think our final budget for the movie itself was about $20,000. And then including all of our promotion and, you know, trailers and the mini tour that we did and everything else, it's probably about $40,000 or $35,000 total. And that's all out of mine and Pete's pocket, actually. So
awesome. So how did you come across Troma Studios, and how did you get distribution from them, mm-hmm. particularly?
Yeah. So if you're living in New York, I mean, I lived in New York for 7 years, and I would say that if you're in New York City and if you're working in the movie industry, which I was, it's almost impossible to not sort of encounter Lloyd, in the sense that I had never met him in person. But by the time I was, you know, the first month I was in film school, I already had met someone that interned over at Troma, and he had had Lloyd in his thesis. And that was like 10 years ago. But then it's like, you know, I by the time I left New York City, I probably knew 5 people that I knew I could just call up and they'd give me his email address because they had worked with him in some way, because he's that sort of accessible. The film community there is that small, and they do enough work where people are always gigging on their projects, and they're just accessible in general. It's like, not to kind of skip ahead, but I now get people asking me like, oh, how did you, you know, sign with Troma? Like your question. And they might say, oh, I made a movie. Like, how do I get distribution with Troma? How do I get them to see it? And I say like, look, you know, to be honest with you, I can't even help you. Like, because you just go on their website and it says right there, send us your film. Like, they're very open about it. They will watch it. I promise you, you send them something, they'll watch it. So that part of it, getting in touch with Lloyd was almost the easiest part. Because, again, I mean, look, if you want Lloyd's email address, I'll fucking give it to you. He'd love for me to do that. It's not a big deal. It's, you know, he's totally accessible. So it's not – that wasn't really a barrier. Basically, the only barrier was that once I talked to him, it's kind of – I basically emailed him and I literally said, you know, hey, Lloyd, my name is Greg. I'm an independent filmmaker. I'm a big fan and I followed your advice. I made my own damn movie, which is a reference to the title of his book, Make Your Own Damn Movie. And I said, my movie's got blood, babes, and bagels. And can I send you a screener? He emailed me back in about 40 minutes and he said, Hectic Knife sounds like the story of my life. Send it in. So I sent it right in. And literally, that's the point when it's basically like, okay. So basically once you send the movie off, you know, Lloyd has now responded and I've sent him off the email of the screener. It's basically just fingers crossed. I mean, my thing is I never really had much hope for the festival circuit with Hectic Knife because it's SD. I shot it on tape on a Panasonic DVX 100B, which at this point is a totally archaic camera. I'm very like super proud to say that I've had people ask me like, oh, did you shoot it on film? Because the look is really designed to mimic like a Darren Aronofsky like pie kind of a look, but it's on tape. So the thing is that it's not to say that festivals won't take it, but I mean, if you imagine your movie that's on tape and they haven't seen it yet and they have a whole giant stack and it also costs you $25 or $50 to submit in the first place and you got to do all this prep work. So you might be out a $1,500 or a grand easy on festivals and only get into one or two. So I was playing it cautious and I basically thought, well, let's try for distribution right off the bat. And because Pete and I were so like, when I say small, it was such a small production, just the two of us. And we had no backing. We had no financing. We had no any connection, anything else. It was just two guys making a movie. So our whole plan initially was to self-distribute. And we basically assumed from knowing about Troma that they will be open to us doing that on our own, but also letting us attach the Troma logo to what we're doing. Meaning like, let's say it's 2014, Hectic Knife's not done yet. Peter and I had it in our heads like, oh, it'd be a dream come true if we could like put on our own mini tour of this movie, hold screenings like across the country on our own dime at small bars and stuff. But wouldn't it be amazing if we could like use the Troma logo as like on a banner that so we can send a press release and it says like, oh, a new Troma movie in town. So it's not just like two guys, right? So that's the dream that we had from the beginning. We're so proud that it came true almost immediately because, like I said, Lloyd was my first email, and they responded back with a contract almost immediately. I mean, it was about a week, and the only response was, yeah, like we want it right away. So I immediately got on the phone with Michael Herz, who is their, you know, it's a Troma team presents, you know, a Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz production. So Michael Herz is like the business side of the whole deal. And, you know, he yelled at me on the phone, like a classic Michael Herz experience, like I'm sure we've all had in the indie business. But no, we struck a deal. It took like a few months to actually like, we had to get a lawyer and like get notes on the contract. I mean, it's a 7-page long contract and it's all got all kinds of stuff going on. You got to read every page with a magnifying glass, but we did it, you know, we signed it and almost I would say exactly what our dream was has come true. I mean, we're able to release the movie on VHS sort of on our own. We were able to print some of our own DVDs before the Blu-ray came out. You know, we've gotten some reviews and, you know, we've obviously able to reach Troma fans directly. So I think the thing with Hectic Knife is that, you know, there's no gratuity, there's no nudity, there's no like sex scenes. There's some raunchy dialogue, but really it's all like language and silly gore. It's really just a comedy. It's not like a horror movie or anything, but you know, regardless of all that, we still fit into the Troma brand. I mean, like Cannibal the Musical was a huge influence on me, and that is kind of what made me know about Troma. And that to me, I'm so honored to like be considered in the same, you know, published catalog as such a great movie as Cannibal. It's like a complete dream come true, like honor. So it really was, it's like a perfect fit for us. And it's really been a dream come true. And they're so like, you know, I mean, they're like 70 years old and they're still smart enough and cool enough and in touch enough to be like, yeah, you know, look, do your thing. You know, we think this is funny and we get it and it fits us and, you know, put our logo on it and do whatever you want, you know, go crazy. And they've let us do that. So like I said, we are able, you know, we had a mini tour. We played about 5 cities across the country in Denver and Fayetteville and St. Louis and Chicago. And then we're going to be out on the coasts at some point in the next couple of years. So we'll be in LA and back in New York and stuff for some shows. But it's just, you know, it's stuff that we're all allowed to do because of Troma. And I can't really say enough good things about them. It's been a dream.
Awesome. Now, yeah. Going into the funny aspect of the movie, how did you guys come up with the idea? Because in the film itself, there are jokes that are about the jokes, in that there is this kind of, and there in it, people do like contextualize, you know, kind of how that you kind of make jokes about how low budget your movie is and how long some of the scenes are, particularly the bagel, the whole bagel joke. And right. Towards the third act of the movie. So where did that idea come from in terms of how did y'all decide on taking that risk with those jokes?
Sure. Well, to be as, you know, transparent as possible and just as honest as possible. I mean, the first obvious thing is that it's patchwork in the sense that we don't have any money. So, and we're also like, we're not making Clerks where the writing is so good and it's such a strong plot that like interweaves together so nicely that we can afford to just like rely on that. So we sort of knew it's like, you know, if we're going to fill up 82 minutes of time, we better sort of be a little bit self-aware about how it's just like white walls and all that stuff. And so it even goes beyond some of the dialogue. It's like we're purposely filming like blank white walls to show you like this is a no budget thing and it's supposed to float on the jokes. And I think, you know, that's the tough thing. It's like there's definitely some people that are really turned off by that style of comedy because it's like if you're not in on the joke, it's just like, well, what is this garbage? That's kind of the first layer. And then the second layer is kind of like if you can even understand it and still hate it because it's basically just like, well, yeah, they didn't have any money and they're just basically like saying they don't, making up for it. And it's like, look, I fully understand that and I can't defend it. You know, there's definitely been people on like IMDb or Amazon who have watched it, you know, from just coming across it, and they're like, yeah, what is, you know, this is just like cheap internet comedy. And I can understand that. My sort of, you know, for me, I'm the biggest influence on Heck of a Night by far was David Wayne, and specifically Wet Hot American Summer, but really all of his catalog. And he's made, you know, The 10, Wanderlust, obviously Wet Hot American Summer was his first feature, and then I'm forgetting him off the top of my head right now, but you know, his style of comedy and the very sort of Andy Kaufman bizarre sort of meta comedy of like Tom Green and Freddy Got Fingered and stuff like that, those were the biggest influences on the movie as a whole. And my basic idea, and this is actually like true, and I'm still amazed that this actually happened. And I'm so blown away by that. I actually use this quote in our artwork as a press quote, is that when I started the movie, I basically thought, you know, is it possible to combine Airplane and Eraserhead? Like, can you make something that's bizarre and atmospheric and strange, but also has these like very sort of dumb banana peel broad slapstick like jokes that are like very wide and like silly and stuff? And just like, it made me misty, like my utter amazement, some person on IMDb wrote this giant like multi-paragraph laudatory review, and he literally said like, look, I've never done this before, I don't normally like review movies on here, but I came across this movie on some place like Troma Now or Amazon Prime or something, and at the bottom of his, he talks about how much he loves it. And then at the bottom, he says it felt like Eraserhead and Airplane. And I was fucking blown. I'm sorry if I swore. Am I allowed to swear?
No, you're fine. I
was blown away that he actually was able to identify. Because I didn't say that anywhere. I didn't say like, you know, I never put that in any kind of artwork or tagline or anything. And I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, I know it's obviously like luck that he mentioned this exact same movies, but I'm blown away that that actually happened. And I, you know, somewhere I was channeling something right. Because, you know, look, Hiding Knife is not anywhere near as good as Airplane or What Had American Summer or Freddy Got Fingered or, you know, the or Eraserhead by any stretch. But the fact that, you know, to me, the ultimate pride that I have with Hiding Knife is that, you know, it was a tiny, no budget, you know, movie on stolen locations. And, you know, we're using fucking a basketball court as India and all that stuff. but it's somehow the idea that the ideas and the jokes make it somehow real to people is just like blows my mind. It's amazing to me because to me, it's still just like Pete and I fooling around and me trying to kind of learn on the fly how to like make a real movie. Because, you know, you remember before, earlier in the, when we were talking, when I listed like my favorite directors there, it's all kind of like Spielberg and Zemeckis and Ivan Reitman and Darabont, like these guys that make like these sort of big Hollywood, like put together productions. And, you know, those are still the, that's still like a big dream that I sort of chase is being able to do that. But obviously you might look at Hexen Knife and think like, well, you know, like that style is that, you know, you can't really make a Hollywood thing where it's like some bizarre, you know, black and white 4:3 universe and everybody's like talking to the camera and it doesn't make any sense and everybody like says what they're about to do. But you know, to me it's all about the craft and it's the style. And like I said, you know, this was influenced by what I think are these brilliant comedies, like, you know, like Spaceballs, another one. It's like a movie like Spaceballs, to me, I'll say the number one influence for Hector Knife of all time is that shot in Spaceballs where they watch the tape of the movie Spaceballs in the movie and they fast forward to the moment because it's so meta. And I'm thinking, you know, that came out so long ago and it's this parody of Star Wars, and it's this big Hollywood thing that everybody knows, like everyone knows Spaceballs. It's got real actors in it. Yet there's this bizarre scene where they're like watching the movie in the movie and they get up to now and they're like in the movie now and they turn it off. It's like those kind of things were, it was kind of like Hector Knife was this experimental thing of like, is it actually possible to make an entire movie only on that premise? And so my thinking was, okay, well, we have like, you know, a superhero to latch onto. We have a villain. We have, you know, we can use these like movie tropes of like big DC and Marvel, you know, Batman movies of today, but maybe I can like boil that down to 80 minutes and then funnel it through this weird comedy vision and maybe that'll work. And again, it's not for everybody. I stress that, you know, there's plenty. I'm very proud of our reviews and our ratings on Rotten Tomatoes and everything, but we certainly get handfuls of these like really negative reviews. And sometimes it's a throwaway negative, but sometimes it's from a person that's like, oh man, you know, that's the kind of person that I really wish we could have like captured because they probably do like good comedy, but they just see it as like cheap nothing. So it's there, you know, I'm still working. I'm still trying to do my best. And Hector Knife is, you know, my first movie and I'm sort of proud of it as like the little movie that could, but, yeah, I don't know. Does that answer your thing? Sorry. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yes. So is it too early to ask for Hectic Knife 3, the search for Hectic Knife 2?
Well, yeah, Hectic Knife 2 was we teased Hectic Knife 2 for a while because right in the excitement of finishing the first one, Pete and I, and mostly Pete, wrote a script for the second one. And so it's written, you know, we need to go do other things. We've been working on the same project for 8 years now. We started in 10 where this Blu-ray is coming out and now it's 18. And, you know, he does his music. I got, you know, other projects I've been doing for 12 years now too, that I need to finish. So we're doing other stuff, but yes, I'm, you know, at some point Hector Knife 2 will probably exist. And we've always intended it to be sort of a trilogy, of course, anyway, because, you know, why would you, if you're going to make Hector Knife, why would you not make it Indiana Jones with, you know, I'm going to say three, I'm not even thinking of the other, you know, other stuff. I'm just saying it's like Star Wars, there were three, you know, Indiana Jones, there were three, Back to the Future, there were three. It's like, why not round it out? So that was always our plan. But, you know, we're just doing other stuff now and hopefully there'll be a demand if the demand keeps going and if people are asking about it and care about it, then we'll definitely jump on it sooner. So.
Awesome. You kind of did touch on it, but what are you working on next?
Yeah. So 12 years ago when I was in New York and I just got the DBX that I ended up shooting Hector Knife on, the first project that I started was a documentary about music. It's a 2.5 hour long project complete with an intermission. I interviewed over 100 people across North America. I have musicians in it from, you know, Grammy-winning, platinum-selling artists like Bela Fleck and Victor Wooten, Bill Fleck and the Flecktones, members of Dave Matthews Band, members of Danny Warhol's Prison United States of America, Sugar Hill Gang, Ari the Rugged Man, Daniel Johnston, who has had two now in full documentaries made about him in the time since I started my movie. So a really eclectic, huge cast of interviewees and subjects that I talked to, plus musicologists and professors from Yale and Juilliard and NYU. It's been a 12-year project in the making. I shot probably 1,000 hours of footage. I have a rough cut happening now. And the next step is I'm basically raising my finishing funds and sort of plotting out the graphics and animation that go, that are going to go in the movie. And, it's a long one. It's a huge one. So I basically had to go off and kind of make a whole movie in between making this thing to even understand how to handle something at such a giant length and all this stuff. And I assume that because of the length, it'll probably end up being cut into pieces in some way. It actually has an intermission, but if it was ever to get on some sort of TV presentation, I'm sure it would have to be formatted or cut into pieces or something like that. But it's a huge undertaking. It's an epic. It's as epic in scope as it is in length and all that. So I'm really proud of it. I'm really excited. Pete is obviously a little bit of a part of it because he's a musician as well. So he'll have kind of he'll work on it in a technical sense. And also he's in there a little bit. So I'm really excited about that. And then also too, I think I mentioned before, but I have an assistant that I work with on Hacked Knife and on my to make a living. I basically just do video work locally, and I just have clients around Michigan and everything from engineering firms, school districts, municipalities, places, things like that. So I have a filmmaking assistant sort of all around. He does cutting for me, but he also is right now as I speak working on Hacked Knife, and he does a thing called Movies to Watch on a Rainy Afternoon, and that's his YouTube review show. He's almost at 100 episodes, and there's one about Hacked Knife, so you can maybe link to that just to give him a little plug and say hello, Addison. His name is Addison Binnick.
Hey,
he just said hi. I don't know if you can hear him.
I'll put a link in the description below. What was it called one more time?
It's Movies to Watch on a Rainy Afternoon. And if you search for that and then put Hacked Knife after that on YouTube, it should come up like first.
All right, cool. Thank you. So to wrap things up, where can the good people find you and your movie, Hacked Knife?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And, I'm on, I personally have a Twitter, but I don't really use it, but I use my Facebook all the time. You can find, Greg, just my name, Greg DeLiso, search for me right there. I should come up on Facebook. I have, Monrovia Pictures, which is the production company that is mine, is the one that we basically did Hacked Knife underneath. We have our YouTube channel and a website. Of course, you can go to the Hacked Knife website, which is just hecticknife.com. And then, of course, Hacked Knife is very active on Twitter and very active. And I think that's actually how we found each other, which is on Twitter. So Hacked Knife is very active on Twitter, and you can see it's really cool. We get to meet cool people like you and do stuff like that. So we're active on Twitter. We're active on Facebook. And obviously, Hacked Knife, I know this is super tacky, but we're on IMDb, we're on Rotten Tomatoes, we're even on Letterboxd, and for a little movie like us, we have 52 votes on IMDb, and that's a ton for a little budding, cult movie. And I can't stress enough, if you see the movie, give it some love on there. And of course, most importantly, where you can actually see the movie, well, it's on Amazon Prime. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can see it there. The Blu-ray is coming out. It is available for pre-order now. So you can pre-order the Blu-ray right now for just $16 on Amazon. And it'll be available on January 9th. And then there's a limited edition VHS release that's coming out on January 16th. And that's actually really cool. I was able to track down 100 blank VHS tapes, and I have put some fun trailers before the movie. Then you got the movie, and then you have some exclusive features after that are only on the tape. There's only 100 copies. They're hand numbered by me, and each one is signed by me and Pete. It's got original artwork, and it's got original artwork and the artwork on the tape itself, on the sticker on the tape and the spine. I drew on it like myself. So I wrote Hacked Knife and I did that stuff. So each tape is its own collector's item. They're $25, but they're a collector's item. If you have a VCR, It's probably the best presentation to see the movie because it's 4:3, it's black and white, so it should look really cool on VHS and be great. So that's coming, and then it's also on Troma now, which I have to definitely plug that, and that's a great thing. Troma has their own streaming service, so for only $4.99 a month, you can go to Troma now and you get access to literally hundreds of movies and shorts and documentaries. Basically, almost all of Troma's back catalog is available. So it's Troma now, and that's this really cool thing. So Hectknife is on there. Addison Binnick's work is on there as well, so you can check that out. He has movies to watch on a rainy afternoon on Troma now. He did one for BC Butcher and for Hectknife, and I think he's done a couple more. So you can check those out. And it's also on limited edition DVD, but we only have about 300 of those left. But you can always get in touch with me if you want one. But we're on everything, man. We're on Blu-ray, VHS, DVD, streaming. It's even been pirated if you do your pirate thing. I noticed, like, if you search for it on YouTube and stuff, it's like there's all those whack ass links that are like, you know, like go here for Hectic, and it's
Spotlocker or something.
Yeah, it's all the torrent, like whatever stuff. So it's on there. So do what you got to do: pirate it, pay Troma, do whatever. But it's available mostly anywhere, so you can check it out.
Awesome, thanks, Greg, for being on the show, and thank you for being on. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday season as we enter the craziest couple of weeks of the year.
Yeah, man. Hey, you too. Thank you so much. I can't appreciate it enough. On our level, for us to be able to go on Twitter and find cool shows like this to be on, it's an honor. I can't thank you enough. And I thank you for watching. And Peter and I both appreciate you like so much. And it's so cool. So thank you all so much. Thanks for having me. And peace out.
All right. Thanks, Greg DeLisa, for coming on the show. Thank you, listeners, for listening to that interview. And please check out Hectic Knife on Amazon Prime and Troma Now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find me at Movie Kale, and you can also follow this podcast at The Youth Critic, and you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast and interviews and whatnot at Cage the Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will be back with you for the Hectic Knife review very shortly and a bunch more content. Thank you.